Hi, everyone. Josh Nason's Punch-Out has returned. I'm Josh Nason, writer, editor, podcaster for the website. It is Thursday, May 18th, 2017. This is episode 66, if you're keeping track of those type of things. Welcome back. Thanks for stopping by. Hope you guys have had a great week and are having a great week and are looking forward to the weekend and staying cool wherever you are. The warm weather has hit us here in New England. It is going to be 90 degrees today, which is a little bit warm. Air conditioning units are in the house finally. And unfortunately, we in our nursery, I know you guys love kids talk, I went to install an air conditioner today and realized that the window will not open up in a manner that will allow me to put an air conditioner in. The hole is only 8 inches, and for some reason, the air conditioner will not go in either side, no matter how I adjust the window. So that was pretty fun to deal with tonight. So needless to say, my daughter is not sleeping in her nursery tonight, sleeping in our room with the AC running. So AC talk, kids talk, UFC talk is what you come here for. We are joined by a very special guest, someone that was on the show, I think, over a year ago or about a year ago. I was trying to look it up and couldn't find it. He is a longtime MMA voice and writer. You know him quite well. He currently writes for Bleacher Report, where he's a columnist. He is Mike Chiappetta, the one and only. He formerly of MMA Fighting and also some other websites as well. Mike and I talked for, 45 minutes about not a lot of news this week, but we kind of skipped around a little bit. We talked about, obviously, some leftovers from UFC 211 this past weekend in Dallas, Texas. Finally, a fun pay-per-view, as expected. A lot of news coming out of that. A lot of discussion points, too, about Eleni and Jacek. Whether she's the greatest female fighter of all time, where Stipe Miocic fits among the greatest heavyweights of all time, and that fun Alvarez-Poirier fight that unfortunately got stopped due to some illegal knees, and all types of other stuff as well. It was a really fun show, so we talked about that. We talked about where we'd like to see who we would like to see Stipe Miocic fight next, and we also chatted about this whole thing, this dust up with Luke Rockhold and Dana White. This era that the UFC finds itself in, and a myriad of other topics. So why don't we just get right to it, and we'll see you after the interview, or we'll talk to you after the interview. So enjoy Mike Chiappetta of BleacherReport.com. Well, it's been a long time since we talk to this fine gentleman on the other end of the Skype connection right now. He's a father of a kindergartner, most importantly. He is a dad, and he is also a Bleacher Report columnist writing about the fine sport of MMA. You've known him in the game forever, and happy to welcome Mike Chiappetta. Yeah, welcome back. Easier said than done. Mike Chiappetta back to Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Mike, it has been a long time, as we said. You've always been in my thoughts, so it hasn't been that far away. We'll start out again with the really tough questions. Did you get your invite to the UFC Fighter Summit Extravaganza coming up here this week?
You know what, Josh? I was about to say that was probably the best introduction I've ever had, putting the father of the child first. Yep. Then you had to bungle my name, and so I've got to grade you down like one notch for that. You were right there, man. You were right there.
I was so close. I get nervous sometimes and all that stuff.
Hey, but you're not the first one to screw it up, believe me. And wait till we talk about Joanna Champion if we get there.
Yeah, that one I got. So Joanna Yen Jacek, that one I've worked on, so that one's good. I was listening to an old show that I did for a ESPN affiliate back like 6 years ago today, and it was the week that it was like 6 years ago last Friday. It was when it got revealed that Brock Lesnar had his second bout of diverticulitis, and I listened to the show. I could not pronounce that phrase, that word for the life of me at that time. And then it just kind of rolls off the tongue. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's a stomach issue. Just say that and move on.
Exactly. You're an old pro at this, being on the MMA beat in the past and doing this forever. So yeah, you know all the tricks.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how difficult it is to talk for a living when you're trying to reach into your mind and give a coherent thought, trying to give some interesting analysis and. you know, you kind of have your mind going in so many different directions at the same time. The pushing and pulling makes things a lot more difficult than people understand.
Well, that's a hell of a lead in for a podcast, isn't it?
We're getting inside baseball here.
Well, the last time you and I talked, you had, I think you had just announced that you were going to Bleacher Report after a little bit of an absence away. So I guess we'll start there. How's the experience been? Obviously, you've been writing some stuff and active and all that. So I guess how's the experience been working for Bleacher Report?
It's been great. I really have enjoyed my time there. It's a good group. And I think the thing I really like the most is they really give us the space and to kind of just say what we have to say. I think, you know, MMA for a long time, people were kind of loath to criticize it just because I think there was a feeling, well, it's a young sport. There's growth pains involved. And to some degree, that is true and correct and fair. But I think there has to reach a point where we have to, you know, call a spade and call them out for the times where they, you know, are trampling on fighters' rights and doing things that, you know, are not fair and just. And so that's what I've enjoyed at Bleacher Report the most. It's not that I want to criticize them. I mean, I wish everything was perfect. That would be great. You know, nobody really gets into covering sports because they want to be negative. Most people get into covering sports because they love sports. And I'm no different. But, you know, I think we owe it to the athletes. We owe it to the sport. We owe it to the people who follow it to write about the sport in an honest and candid way and to, you know, expose these things that go on behind the scenes while at the same time celebrating the things that go right. And I think Bleacher Report is really, really super good at that. I think that's one of our strengths is we have a group of writers who are very seasoned. They've seen the ins and outs of the business. And we're not afraid to, you know, criticize the UFC where it's necessary because we're not, you know, we don't go to a lot of shows. So there's not really not a big, we don't feel like we're risking anything. Like I know people talk about that, when they criticize MMA websites and people who cover the sport say, you know, of course they're afraid to risk the wrath of
the credentials thing, right? It always
comes the credentials
like,
thing. And I think that's always been overstated. I mean, I never had that concern when I was at other outlets, but I just feel like, you know, at Bleacher Report, you know, that's one of the first thing that's kind of, I don't want to say it's the lifeblood of the site to be critical or anything like that. But I think it's ingrained in us that we are going to cover this as we would any other professional sport. When something is done the right way, the correct way, praise them, whether it's the athlete, whether it's management. But you know, when the time comes to criticize, don't be afraid to, don't pull punches. So I've enjoyed that quite a bit.
So yeah, it's very interesting. It seems like this is always an interesting time for MMA media just because the way that the sport is, and there's this, I guess in all sports media, there's this kind of like co-opted thing going on where it's almost like if you get in with an athlete or in with a team, it's almost as, I don't want to say as effective, but for lack of a better phrase, I guess we'll say that in that if you're trying to get scoops and you're trying to get inside knowledge and get ahead of the rest of the pack, it's almost like you have to be non-critical to start with and then let other people kind of do the heavy lifting. And I think in MMA, it's so unique where, you know, you'll get to know fighters, you get to know camps and things like that. And it's a very personal thing where it's almost like you can't be critical of someone that you're really close with or else that is kind of that there's friction there and that may eliminate you from getting inside information about other stuff. And it's just this, you may be afraid to make people upset, but then again, you kind of have to if you're doing your job. And the fact that the main organization, the sport, is still so shrouded in secrecy and just not out there. And there's not, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. When it comes to like a lot of the questions that we have about the sport and happenings and things going on, there's not like a real good opportunity to have an ongoing dialogue with.
Oh, there's almost none.
Yeah. I mean, with other sports, there is, and it's so much different in MMA. It's crazy.
If you think about it, you know, the UFC was bought by this new ownership group, WMEIMG. We're coming up on a year now. It was last July. And they've literally never spoken with the media at all. I mean, this ownership, other than Dana White, obviously, who remains the public face of the company, the other guys behind the sale, who are now the, you know, co-CEOs, I believe is their title, Ari Emanuel and Patrick Weitzel, have never spoken to the media at all. And it's not that they have to, but it's name another sport where that happens. I mean, if you cover, you know, if you cover the New York Yankees, the ownership group talks to the media at least a few times a year, whether it's in spring training at the beginning of the year to give an outlook on the team, or after the playoffs to talk about, you know, what went wrong, what went right, and where the future's headed. You know, it's pretty mind-boggling to me that they spent $4 billion to buy this company, and they have had very limited interaction with the media other than through, you know, the usual channels. You know, if even to just talk about the direction they're taking this thing, you know, Dana White, obviously he always proclaims, you know, wait till you see what we're doing next and wait till you see where we're going and all these sorts of things. And that's fine. But, you know, it'd be nice to get a little more detail. There's no reason for it to be shrouded in mystery, though. I mean, that's the thing that's strange. I mean, how does it benefit them to sort of stay anonymous and behind the scenes? I mean, I think I just don't think they have any interest in the MMA media, to be honest with you. I mean, I think for the most part, they've only done things with, you know, some of the huge mainstream sites. And I mean, Bleacher Report is a huge sports site, but, you know, even still, if we tried to reach out to them and set up some interview, it probably wouldn't happen. And I think it's to the detriment of the athletes and fighters. I mean, because these people can put their fighters in the limelight in front of major media organizations, and for whatever reason, they really haven't done that.
Very weird time, and that also goes to the relationship between fighters and management. And we've been seeing so many examples of this throughout the you know, past few months, growing fighter unrest. It's kind of what this fighter summit, so to speak, is coming up, is maybe hoping to quell a little bit. But I can't get over this this public Twitter beef between Luke Rockhold and Dana White. This is I would have never, you know, I want to say I would have never thought, but someone like Luke Rockhold basically tweeting at Dana White to think before you run your mouth. And, you know, for Dana basically be like, you know, leave the matchmaking to us and kind of do it publicly.
I love Dana's comeback. Like, I would never do this, but now I'm going to come back to you. Like, what?
I know.
Entire history.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of absurd, but I kind of got a laugh out of it.
So, I mean, this is basically like the, not the tip of the iceberg, but it's like the latest thing of just this growing unrest. But it's interesting as a story, but I don't know where this kind of puts anyone. Like, this doesn't necessarily put us near a fighters union or, you know, anything like that. It's just like, okay, there's more people upset with the UFC, but kind of that seems to be all it is. And ultimately these guys have to work, you know, guys have to fight. And my guess is Luke Rockhold doesn't have enough money in the bank to just say, okay, I'm done with this. So it's just this weird kind of vibe between the fighters and the promotion. And I mean, you've been covering this sport for a long time. I mean, could you ever imagine we'd be in this spot?
Yeah, I think I can. Okay. I think it's pretty easy to imagine for me. I think, you know, I mean, going back from when I first started covering the sport, I mean, literally within a couple of months of covering the sport, I was hearing, you know, fighter gripes about the UFC and why am I not making more money? You know, that was kind of the first golden age of the UFC in terms of really making quite a bit of money on pay-per-view. And there were stars at the top of the card wondering, you know, why am I making $12,000 when this event's selling 600,000 units? That math just didn't add up to them. And going on to, you know, when promotion like Affliction came around and started offering people these enormous paydays, obviously that economic model did not work either. But I think that was one of the first times when fighters felt emboldened to speak out. I remember Andre Arlovsky kind of reaching the end of this deal, and they sort of froze him out. He wasn't able to fight for a year. He really didn't say much about it publicly, but, you know, I think behind the scenes he made it pretty clear that he was not happy with the way things had gone. And I think, you know, once kind of the first crack in the dam happened, and then it was sure that more fighters were going to follow in terms of publicly voicing their displeasure. I think it becomes easier. It's kind of a strength in numbers thing, right? I mean, as tough as these guys are, and as courageous as they are to be what they do, I think it's never easy to go against the boss, because you know that you are putting yourself potentially in a situation where there can be some repercussions against you. And that's not something – that's not a situation most people, whether you're a fighter or you're just a regular person working a 9-to-5 job, would want to do. But – you know, as we've seen more and more people be comfortable with it, I think they understand, you know, they probably feel like there's more safety in numbers. And, you know, speaking of Luke Rockhold, since you brought him up, I mean, I think at one point he even suggested, like, hey, Yoel Romero and the rest of the crew, let's all sit out. You know, let's all sit out until the UFC sorts this out, because this is ridiculous that they're holding the division up for no reason. And I thought that was really interesting to see, because, you know, as you stated, I mean, maybe we are kind of spinning our wheels in terms of getting to a fighters association or union. I mean, we've had multiple groups try and step up and do something. And I know, you know, at least one of those groups is still around. But it's, you know, it's something that's moving at a glacier pace. And I think that that's probably going to continue. I mean, until these guys band together, whether it's at an event like this fighters union where they're all together and they kind of get in a room and decide, like, hey, you know what? If we all turn down fights, what could the UFC do? You know, they'd have no choice but to allow us to form an association or negotiate with us for better pay or better rights or whatever it may be. I think they have that power within them. They're just not able to pull it together. And, you know, of course, it's quite a challenge. I mean, you're talking about 500 people from all corners of the globe. I mean, it is a monstrous challenge. But I think it's going to be drip, 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 drip until it ends up being a deluge somewhere down the line that can no longer be contained by the UFC.
And it looks like Rockhold may have to wait for any type of Bisping rematch, or the whole division still, Mike, is revealed today. On his radio show, Bisping said that it's no problem that the St. Pierre fight is off right now because he has a lingering knee injury that he needs to have taken care of and have cleaned up. And he still said he's here for no official word from the UFC that the fight's off. So he still wants that fight next because he wants the big, quote unquote, big money payday.
Really?
And
I don't play.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, I don't know. From the sporting aspect, Yoel Romero has definitely earned that shot, and that was something you really look forward to. But, I mean, I don't – it's just so the St. Pierre thing at 185 got so confusing, you know, just kind of messed this whole thing up. And, I don't know. So, I mean, so given that Bisping, we don't know how long he's going to be hurt, I mean, if given the option, would you rather see Bisping Romero next or Bisping versus GSP?
Well, first of all, I think it's kind of convenient that he brings up this knee injury again all of a sudden, because I think a few weeks ago he mentioned in a social media that the knee was good, back to normal, ready to get back to training and ready to get into his next fight camp. All of a sudden, GSP is not ready and he's not ready either.
Yeah, amazing.
That being said, it's quite a coincidence there. But you know what? I cannot blame the guy. I mean, you know, when talk about putting in time. I mean, the guy's been, you know, one of the UFC stalwarts for over a decade. You know, he paved the way for them in the UK, or certainly was one of the guys who paved the way as far as building popularity and building a market there. He has put in his time. I mean, this is a guy who's, you know, walking around literally with, you know, one of those badges. When you look at his eye, I mean, it's pretty fair to see this guy has given a piece of himself to this fight career that he's created, as well as this promotion. That's his blood and you know, that he's given them. So I think, you know, in an instance like that, I think it's a little more understandable that you're Michael Bisping, I think is what, 37 years old now, 38.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a lot of huge paydays in front of him. When the time comes that he loses the belt, I mean, he's pretty much said that's pretty much going to be it for him. So if that is the case, that's what he should be doing. He should be trying to maximize his final paydays for the sake of his family and his future. His legacy is pretty much written. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, we always thought was going to go down as the best fighter never to win a championship. He won the championship. He's got a lot of good names on his resume. So he's doing exactly what he should be doing as a prize fighter, which is going for the biggest payday. So I don't blame him whatsoever. I mean, personally, obviously, when you look, you know, at this, when you want to look at this as a sport from that perspective, you say, you know, poor Yoel Romero or the rest of the division. I mean, is that fair to hold up the entire division because of the UFC's need to put together these big money fights? Because as great as George St. Pierre has been over the course of his career, as big as he was as a building block in Canada, he's got a lot of the same attributes as Michael Bisping. And, you know, you can make a case that this guy deserves it as a career, kind of a career achievement award in some respects, that he gets this kind of fight. But from a sporting perspective, I mean, he has not earned it. He's been out for 3 years. I mean, the sport has moved on, the divisions have moved on, and he's never even competed in this fight, let alone won in this division, I should say, rather than won a fight there. So, you know, there's definitely arguments to be made on either side, but I think when it comes to holding up a division, you know, if I'm the UFC, I think it's fair for Dana White to say, you know, we tried to put together this George St. Pierre Michael Bisping fight in an expedient way that wouldn't hold up the division for a long period of time. And now that we can't do that, we have to move on. You know, if George is not ready till November, well, then he could fight the winner of the Bisping Romero fight then, when he's ready. But for them to hold the division just for that reason, I don't think makes a whole lot of sense for them other than, you know, in a monetary way. And it's a complicated issue, obviously, because the UFC does want to be taken seriously, but we all know that the bottom line is, are they making their revenue targets and earnings targets? And I think when push comes to shove, that kind of stuff's always going to win out.
Yeah. You think we'll actually see GSP fight before the end of the year? There's part of me that feels like something is going to happen and all of a sudden it's going to get delayed and we're not going to see this happen before the end of the year. And there's just this little part of me that wonders if now this means we're never going to see him at all. I don't, you know, it's weird how life works sometimes. I don't know. I'm just, what do you think?
Yeah, I have my doubts too. I mean, I think, you know, for the longest time I was certainly a proponent of, you know, come back, George, come back if you want to. You really need to do this for yourself for whatever reason. I mean, I would have loved for him to just have walked into the sunset and said, right into the sunset, I'm the champion, and that's the last image you'll have of me, is me with that belt over my shoulder walking away. But if he wants to come back, I felt a long time ago, you know, he has the right to ask for, you know, whatever fight he wants. And he did that. But again, I just don't feel like he should be holding up the division. I think that, you know, he has been a guy that has been injury prone in the past. He's obviously getting older. When you get older, you don't get less injury prone. So if he's already pushing us back to November now, I mean, it's certainly possible. And that's, to me, that's the reason why I wouldn't wait for him. It's like you've already pushed us back once. You know, we've waited. You've been talking about this comeback for literally over a year. And now when we pull the trigger, you're not ready. So, you know, basically tell us when you're ready and then we'll do something about it then. I have the same feeling as you. Like, I'm not really going to believe that he's going to fight again until I see him on the dais in fight week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, there's just part of me now that's just wondering. I don't know. It stranger things have happened. But I would not be surprised if for whatever reason the return of any sort gets delayed, and then if it gets delayed to next year, that maybe this thing doesn't happen after all. But we'll have to see. What did happen was some fun action this past Saturday at UFC 211. We had a really fun show, really fun pay-per-view. It is wild that we are midway through May and we finally had a really good pay-per-view that was well worth it. The whole card was really fun. Lots of lots of notables, especially on the FX prelims, obviously on the main card itself. As we sit here a few days past the big event, what are your key takeaways? What are you going to remember about the show?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people left this event talking about, you know, is Stipe the greatest UFC champion that we've ever had, which is, you know, an interesting thought experiment, and is Joanna Jędrzejczyk the best female fighter we've ever had? I think we've heard a lot of people talk and write about that over the last couple of days. But for me, my takeaway, which I wrote about in a piece on Wednesday that went up on Bleacher Report, was about Frankie Edgar. Because, you know, for me, when I think about MMA, I just think about how difficult it is to sustain periods of excellence. I mean, careers in MMA at the UFC level are so short. You know, look at Ronda Rousey, for an example. I mean, she came on the scene as a ball of fire, won fights incredibly convincingly, and then was gone as quickly as she arrived. And we've seen that a lot of times. I mean, it's difficult to hold on to belts. It's difficult to stay relevant for long periods of time. And I was looking at Frankie Edgar's career in terms of its entirety. It's basically a 10-year block. And I think he's probably one of the most underrated and underappreciated fighters we've ever had. And I think if you look at UFC fighters in 10-year blocks, because there's only a few of them who've you know, lasted that long, he has a case to be arguably the second or third best fighter in a 10-year block. I mean, if you look at Anderson Silva, by the end of his 10th year, you know, he's being knocked out multiple times and testing positive for performance-enhancing drugs. If you look at guys like Tito Ortiz, by the end of his 10 years, he was going, you know, losing fights and you know, basically on his way out as a contender and his way out of the UFC. Chuck Liddell, by the end of his 10 years, he lost three or four. His retirement talk had begun to swirl around here. I think that's pretty common. I mean, MMA is not a career that's built for longevity, just like professional football. So to me, my takeaway was Frankie Edgar, this 10-year block of greatness he's had where he's, you know, exhibited incredible courage, incredible well-rounded skills in every facet of the game. I mean, there's nothing he's not good at. He's a really excellent boxer. You know, his jiu-jitsu is really strong. He's never been submitted. He's never been knocked out. He's never been finished. You know, sure, he's lost fights, but he's been a champion. And the other thing is he's always fought higher than he should be fighting as far as weight classes goes. He's never been one of these guys to do these extreme weight cuts. When he was the heavyweight, when he was the lightweight champion, he was basically walking around on weight year round. I mean, he literally cut three to four pounds to make weight, which is just insane. Mm-hmm. And he's been that successful. And I think we reached a point now where people are wondering, you know, when is the end coming for Frankie Edgar? Because even more impressive, generally lightweights don't age well, right? Because there's such an incredibly deep talent pool for one thing, compared to like heavyweight where, you know, it's the same 10, 15 names getting recycled for years. In lightweight, you know, there's just contenders, waves of contenders, new contenders coming up one after the other. And, you know, this was a situation, actually we're talking featherweights here, but you know what I mean, lighter weight fighters. You have a young and flashy fighter, a prospect, Yair Rodriguez, who a lot of people thought, you know, this guy is going places, and he probably still is. But a lot of people thought, you know, is he going to do the same kind of thing to Frankie Edgar as he did to BJ Penn? And the answer was not even close. I mean, Frankie Edgar is just so good that if you do not bring your A game, he is going to wreck you. And that's exactly what we saw. And I think that people need to think about Frankie Edgar and what he's done in his career a little more than they have. He really deserves an incredible amount of credit for what he's done during the course of his 10-plus year career.
And those are some great points, and kind of just looking over the past few years. This is just the past few years, this run he's been on. So people would love this in a whole career. This is just the past couple of years. Wins over Charles Oliveira, BJ Penn, Cub Swanson, Uriah Faber, Chad Mendes. That was five in a row. The loss to Jose Aldo, and then wins over Jeremy Stephens, and then Yair Rodriguez this past week. And many of those were obviously convincing. He was finishing fights, and obviously the Faber fight was kind of a dud for whatever reason, but he obviously won that one. But the way that he's doing, I mean, Chad Mendes is no joke. Yair Rodriguez, you know, a good prospect on the rise, but I think maybe the guys he had beat to got here maybe kind of inflated that a little bit. But I mean, he just went in there Saturday and simply he decimated Yair Rodriguez, just simply took him out. And Frankie Edgar, this is guys that, you know, during those lightweight runs, he was, I mean, the Gray Maynard fights, those are stuff of legend when he comes that era and just how violent and brutal those were. I wonder if, you know, there was that stretch when he was a lightweight champion. Essentially, he fought three guys over a span of 3 years. It was BJ Penn, Gray Maynard, and Benson Henderson. That was it. And a lot of, obviously, decisions and all that stuff, other than the one knockout of Gray Maynard and that fun fight. I wonder if, for some reason, that stretch that people just really – they weren't really into him. Maybe they weren't kind of ready for what Edgar was doing. You just really connect that well. Obviously, his fighting style has changed a little bit in different weight class and everything. But I wonder if that run – hurt him in the eyes of some people that
I know what you mean, but it's like, you know, he's fighting BJ Penn, and you know, that first fight where he fought BJ Penn, and it was obviously controversial. They fought in Abu Dhabi. It was a controversial decision, and you know, people demanded the rematch. I believe Frankie was the underdog in the rematch as well. That was in Boston. I remember I was at that fight.
Yep.
And the rematch was a very convincing. Frankie clearly won that fight. And I, to me, it's like, if you didn't realize right then that this guy's as real as it gets as a champion and an elite talent, I don't know, you know, what you're doing when you're watching MMA. But, you know, even if you had questions then, or maybe, you know, maybe his style is not your style, because, you know, he's not a flashy guy. He's not flashy in the cage or out, really. I mean, he's a soft-spoken guy, he's a humble guy, family kind of guy. And I kind of wrote about that in my piece. I mean, he's not, you know, typically in MMA, the people that we really embrace, or the fan, I'm talking about, you know, guys who go wide as superstars, are sort of the counterculture, you know, bad boys and bad girls who, you know, say the things that we wish we could say. And you know what I mean? And he's never been that guy. He's super professional. You know, he's fairly soft spoken, and he's just a business. He's basically a businessman in MMA. And so I think that's probably the thing that hurt him the most as far as, you know, exploding in popularity. But to me, you know, when you, I do think in a sense UFC dropped the ball in promoting him too, because he's a guy that was like, you know, an Arturo Gatti, Mickey Ward kind of like blood and guts fighter who, as I said, you know, he was literally in every fight he's ever been in his entire career undersized. I actually went back and looked. There's not one fight in his entire UFC career where he was the taller fighter. Mm. And I would pretty much bet, you know, my last dollar that he was the smaller fighter in weight too. I mean, who would weigh more than Frankie Edgar when they competed? I mean, the only guy I thought was maybe a possibility was Hermes Franco when they fought, because he was kind of a smaller guy too. But literally everybody else he's fought was bigger than him. And to still have this incredible record and to be that blood and guts fighter who can be in a war like that against Gray Maynard and come back and win – it's incredible. And to beat legends like BJ Penn and to go through a three fight losing streak like he did and still come back and win 7 out of 8 as he's done in the last couple of years. I mean, to me, that just speaks volumes about the kind of person he is, the kind of fighter he is, the work ethic he has. Cause you know, I think, you know, as well as I do in this sport, you're either all the way in or you're all the way out. If you have any kind of doubt in your mind about how good you are or about whether you should be in there or not, it's usually going to show up on fight night. Frankie Edgar is about the most game fighter I've ever seen. You know, he's never beaten himself. You know, he's always fighting you tooth and nail to the final horn. He's impossible to finish. I mean, to me, there's like nothing to not like about the guy. He's definitely, you know, different than the this kind of superstars that we've kind of created in the past, or the people that the fans have made superstars in the past. But I think he should be admired for all those different reasons.
And the unfortunate thing, almost tragic in the fight sense, he's never going to get that Conor fight. We're never going to see that.
Yeah. I don't think Conor's never making it back to 145. No. I mean, it doesn't make sense for him too. And you know, I mean, I think he's only, you know, if anything, he's only going up to 170, or most likely he'll stick to 155. And if he comes back at all, maybe, that's a whole other conversation.
Maybe Frankie should start campaigning for a fight against Floyd Mayweather instead.
I mean, I would watch Frankie Edgar fight for a parking spot outside an apartment store. I mean, you know, you kind of get the feeling like that he is the kind of guy that would fight for. I mean, I remember I read something recently. I think it was a story on MMA Junkie. I wish I can give it a proper attribution. I think it was MMA Junkie, where he just talked about the fight with Gray Maynard. And he said, you know, he didn't – first of all, he doesn't remember the fight. I think it was the second fight that they were talking about. And he doesn't remember really the fight at all, which is really no surprise if you watch it. It's scary, but it's not really surprising. But basically he said, you know, the thing he learned about himself – at that time is like, I literally am willing to die in the cage. Like, I don't want to die in the cage. I love my children and family and I want to be around for them. But I think my automatic pilot is I'm going to do everything I can to my final breath to try to win. And the thing is, other fighters say that and you kind of like roll your eyes, you know? I mean, obviously there's a huge element of danger every time they walk in the cage, but you don't really feel like, you know, you're willing to die. I mean, that's pretty extreme. But, I mean, I think he's proven it. You know, I think he has proven it. So he's one of the few that has gone to those depths. And we've been able to see that and see him rise back up again. And that's remarkable to me.
A couple other notes from the card, and then we'll get some other thoughts from you. Let's see. The UFC, unfortunately, the way that Alvarez-Poirier ended, that was really fun fight. Unfortunately, the knees from Alvarez ended that, and we'll see kind of how that turns out. However, I think there is a little bit of a silver lining for UFC in that I think they can make that fight easily again at some point and either headline maybe a Fox show or do a co-main on a pay-per-view. I think they may have lucked out there, and we'll get to hopefully see that again. And
yeah, they also lucked out because they didn't have to pay a win bonus, right?
Exactly. I know, exactly. Yes, they win all the way around. House always wins. Jason Knight, I thought, looked really good. This guy from Mississippi that, you know, us Northerners tend to have biases against, these Southern guys and how they talk and all that stuff. But Jason Knight, he looks pretty good. We'll have to see what happens at 145. Interesting stuff there. James Vick looked good. But then, you look at the rest of the main card, I think the standout things, obviously Stipe just dominant over JDS. I'd kind of, in my mind leading into this fight, I'd kind of thought that maybe UFC was booking this as a little bit of a squash match, so to speak, and that, you know, JDS had not fought for over a year. I had completely forgot about that his last fight was a year ago, and then he's getting this title shot. And I think Stipe is just, you know, miles ahead of him at this point in his career, especially after some of the beatings that JDS took, especially against Miocic in that first fight. And I think Stipe is at a separate level right now from a lot of the guys. I think, I'm interested to see my thought when I was talking about this last week was that my hope was that, My thought was that the UFC hoped that maybe Stipe won fast without injury, and that maybe Derek Lewis wins fast without injury when he fights Mark Hunt in June, and maybe you can make that happen on a quicker turnaround for August if both guys were down for it and so on. Dave Meltzer brought up, you know, he thought Cain Velasquez is the clear choice for a fight that they'd want to make. Cain's been basically on the shelf with an injury. You know, it seems we've been seeing that for the past 3-4 years. Who would you like to see him take on? Or maybe either those two guys, maybe someone up for Risha Verdum, the winner of that fight he's got coming up against Overeem. What do you think?
Yeah, I think to me, like, Cain Velasquez is sort of the obvious guy that UFC would be most likely to go with, just because he's obviously a name that people know. I think they have – I don't want to say they're sort of similar in their styles. Both guys who can fight with some pace and pressure, both good wrestlers, both pretty decent boxers. And they both have a good highlight reel. So I think it'd be an easy fight to promote for them. I think maybe a wild card. I mean, would they consider throwing Francis Ngannou in there? I would say it's probably a little too early, but, you know, we've seen in the past, I mean, the UFC, I don't want to say rush guys into title fights, but, you know, I think this is a case where you talk about heavyweights, the heavyweight division is just thin. I mean, we've already seen pretty much all these guys that we just named have fought for the belt at one time or another. So at some point, if you want to bring in some newer young blood and do something interesting, you know, would that be something they take a shot at? We do see that they're interested in building new stars, and I'm sure that he's somebody that they think can, you know, can become a star. I mean, he's obviously got a pretty unique look to him, and he's from France, and France is a part of the world that does not embrace MMA. So maybe they might look at that as a way to sort of break that barrier by putting him in there and seeing how the media there in France reacts to it, or if they give him a shot, if they're willing to embrace it. I mean, I think that's probably something they might like to think about. You know, maybe it's one more fight away. Maybe Ngannou has to, you know, to get there. But, you know, as we've seen, their decisions can be kind of arbitrary. So, you know, I try to think in terms of, like, you know, what's going to make them the most money, or what's going to get them to where they want to go in terms of, you know, ulterior motives in the future. And to me, I look at France as one of those. When they obviously they haven't done as much in terms of international markets as the past ownership team did in the last few years. But I think I'm sure that's something that's going to be coming. I don't think WMEING bought this outfit for $4 billion to make them a US only setup.
Yeah.
So that's just a matter of time.
Yeah. I wonder about Ngannou in that. I think that they would love some of these older guys in the heavyweight division. Is so many older guys, the 35,
yeah, 35. Pretty much all it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if they'd love Ngannou to maybe knock out one more kind of the old guard. And then, you know, perhaps you kind of like start playing for like the next couple of years. Like you think, okay, could a Miocic and Ngannou fight? You kind of build it a little bit more, and kind of these guys, maybe Derek Lewis again, he's another kind of younger guy or a newer heavyweight in that mix. And maybe you kind of say a year from now, we'd love this to be our top five. And maybe you kind of use Ngannou and Lewis to kind of start knocking off.
Do you think they have that kind of patience though?
it all depends what they need. It depends what they need the coffers at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think obviously when you look at Ngannou's resume, you know, he probably does need at least one more fight to prove that he really deserves to be in that title fight. You know, on the other hand, you know, I guess you can say, all right, we can throw him in there with Stipe. And if he loses, we can say, well, you know, maybe it was a little too much too soon to him, and it won't necessarily be that difficult to build him back up, as we've seen in the heavyweight division. If you win two in a row, you're in the title hunt. So, you know, even if he loses a title fight, even if it's premature in his career, you know, that's not necessarily the end for him. It's probably not even close to the end. I mean, he's 30 in the UFC's heavyweight division. He's a baby. So, you know, I think that, you know, that kind of thing plays into their thought process as well. But if we're being honest with ourselves and we're doing right by him, I think probably having one more fight against a high-ranked fighter is helpful, because, you know, he went from Anthony Hamilton to Andre Arlovsky in his last fight, which is, you know, that's a fine progression. But Andre Arlovsky at this stage of his career, you know, he's not what he was a few years ago. So I think, you know, you'd like to see him fight someone in between that, you know, number five to number two sort of contender range to get him to that title shot.
I could see them. This would be a good idea. If anyone's listening from UFC, you could do Stipe versus Cain as your main event. And then you could do in the co-main Ngannou versus the winner of Derek Lewis and Mark Hunt. And then you also have some protection there in case Cain gets injured, and then everyone wins. That's a nice pay-per-view buy and everyone's happy. Heavyweights fighting. I mean, that's a no lose situation.
Yeah. Remember a few years ago when they did the heavyweights only main card? I think it was Memorial Day weekend.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Right. And that was great. I mean, obviously they don't do that kind of promotion very often. I think that was, as far as I know, the only time in UFC history that they had a card that was filled only with one main card filled only with one weight class. But it was a pretty cool little gimmick, and it worked out super well for them. Obviously, with heavyweights, there's always that added intrigue too. So I would love to see them do something like that again. And I know it's difficult because obviously, as we said before, the heavyweight division is so shallow that if you put that many on one card, first of all, it's difficult to time that the right way to have them all ready at the same time. And then if you do pull it off, you know, then you have a lot of guys who are going to have to sit for a couple of months, and you're not going to be able to book any meaningful heavyweight fights for a while. So it is a challenge to pull off, but if they could do it, it would be awesome to see.
Final question. Where do you find yourself on this Joanna Jędrzejczyk best female fighter of all time discussion that you mentioned earlier? Where do you sit?
I think at this point you still have to look at Chris Cyborg as number one. I mean, you know, I think the thing that you can obviously knock her for, and it's perfectly valid, is the drug testing issue she's had in the past. You know, it's pretty easy to sort of disqualify her for that. It's hard to do though. I mean, she's had, you know, an incredibly decorated career. She's pretty much thrashed everyone she's ever competed against, when she's competed at these high level promotions, Invicta, Strikeforce, UFC. So to me, I don't think we can just usurp that crown from her just yet. Joanna is certainly, you know, in that conversation, and she's building herself a great resume and a great case. But, you know, this division that she's in is still forming. She's fought some decent opponents, but I think they both kind of suffer from that in a way, because neither of those divisions is super deep, whether it's the strawweight class or the women's featherweight class. Neither of them is super deep. So, but if I had to choose, and I guess you're making me, I would put Cyborg as number one, and Joanna and Rousey have to be neck and neck. I mean, because listen, we can't just throw Rousey aside just because she lost twice. I mean, she certainly lost in very convincing fashion, but her reign as short as it was very, very dominant. I mean, she was beating women in literally, you know, a minute. And we don't see that in championship fights very often. So, you know, I think it's not very fair to her to kind of throw her out of the conversation completely. But Joanna is definitely right there alongside of her.
The correct answer, Mike, was Jermaine Durandamy. That is the greatest female fighter.
Oh, is she still fighting?
Yeah, I supposedly. I guess what a weird situation. 145.
Yeah, totally strange.
My guess is I would not be surprised that division just kind of goes away, depending on what they do with Cyborg and this whole thing about October. She's going to get two fights in before October, or else she becomes a free agent. And you know that a certain promotion owned by Viacom would love to have Chris Cyborg there. And to me, if they don't have her, then I mean, what's the point of having this belt, right?
Yeah. To me, the whole thing with these recent women's divisions is an example of, you know, why we want to talk to this UFC ownership team. You know, they always talk about these great plans they have, but you know, when you really pay close attention, you have to feel like they're flying by the seat of their pants a lot of the time. I mean, this featherweight division is one example. They still, I mean, as far as I know, if you go on the UFC rankings page, there's no rankings for UFC featherweight women because there's not enough of them.
Right.
There was no plan there. That means exactly that there was no plan. They just threw it together. And it's the same thing with the women's flyweight division that they sort of announced and they took it back. Then they said, oh, no, we were right the first time. I mean, it's to me, you know, if there's a clear and coherent plan, those things don't happen. So it's pretty obvious to me that they do fly by the seat of their pants a lot. I know in some cases you have to. You have fighters getting injured and dropping out and retiring unexpectedly and all these kinds of things. And I completely understand that. But when you're talking about the formation of divisions, you would think there'd be a little more thought that goes into it.
Mm, I would agree. Well, there's been a lot of good thoughts on this podcast, and I appreciate you stopping by. But however, before I let you go, Mike, I want to toss you the microphone, give you a chance to channel your inner Chael Sonnen and tell people and plug away where they can follow you on social media, some stuff you have come out for Bleacher Report. The floor is yours.
I'm not going to cut a Chael Sonnen-like promo, although I could. But people can feel free to follow me on Twitter at Mike Chiappetta and read my work at BleacherReport.com. Josh, thanks very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm glad we were able to get this worked out. Good luck with America's number one kindergartner.
That's right.
Good luck with myself.
Undisputed, baby.
Exactly. Until my 7th month old, she's coming. She's coming, what, 5 years? Is that what it is? Like 5th or 6th grade? 5 or 6 years old? Is that what kindergarten is? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's 5. Yeah.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, she'll hold the crown for a while, and then, you know, by that point, it'll be America's number one 5th grader.
Yes.
Good.
Absolutely.
Good pace. Keep her away from female MMA, though, Mike. I'm going to keep my daughter away from the same.
She has never seen one fight.
No.
I know some people let their 2 and 3 year old kids watch. I don't know. It's like, you know, even though you can tell them they're competing or saying something, kind of talking around it. I just don't think it's proper for that age.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree as well. And that's a discussion for another day that we'll definitely have to have. Mike Chiappetta, thanks so much for joining Josh Nixon's Punch Out this week. Welcome back.
My pleasure. Thanks, Josh. Take care.
All right. Big thanks to Mike Chiappetta for stopping by and hanging with me for 45 minutes. Again, you can follow him on Twitter, read his work at Bleacher Report, let him know you heard him on the show, and I would greatly appreciate it. Let's see. So if you are subscribed to the RSS feed, you probably got one new show downloaded, and also you could also see it on the site as well, I guess, from JNPO Retro, and it was the WJAM MMA show. And let's give you kind of a quick synopsis here. It is a show that I did 6 years ago, starting this past week. Actually, last Friday, 6 years ago, was when the show officially launched on May 12th, 2011. And I found this this drive, and I found some old shows, and I want to have a place for them. So I figured, what better spot than here? There's all kinds of interviews with different fighters, and the show, it came out really well. It was professionally produced. It was a ESPN affiliate in Nashua, New Hampshire, which is now no longer the station, not Nashua. Nashua, unfortunately, still exists. But it was just kind of an interesting time capsule to go back and you know, I know that sometimes people are not really keen to go back and listen to old audio, although on our side, a lot of people do. What was interesting is, so I'm listening to these back for the first time in like 6 years. And this first show, let's see, the first one, we had some breaking news that Brock Lesnar was out with a second bout of diverticulitis. The UFC lightweight championship was a fight between Frank Edgar and Gray Maynard. The rematch had to be postponed due to injury. And we also, what was the other thing? Oh, the UFC fighters got health insurance. And we talked about how, you know, it was going to be a big difference maker for the UFC in that it was a better place to fight. And maybe if you're competing with Bellator for fighters and you can give them health insurance, you know, it's going to be a big boon for the fighters. They're taking care of their guys. And you fast forward to 6 years later and the fighter unrest, some of the stuff we talked about on this show with Mike, it's kind of just interesting to see how far we've come or how far we haven't come in 6 years since then. So it's really fascinating stuff to me. Rick Hahn, former Bellator fighter, now retired, a judo trainer and down here in New Hampshire. He was the interview for the show, and that was kind of fun. So I think, you know, if you're into MMA history, you want something kind of just on the background, I think it's kind of fun to listen to these shows. And every show, I'll just do a quick intro, kind of let you know what was going on behind the scenes, if there was anything, and kind of just do a quick intro for the show. So if you guys like those, they'll be released every week on the site. And tomorrow will be the only time there'll be 2 in a week because I want to catch up. So the Friday the 19th will be 6 years ago, so I'll release that on Friday if you kind of follow along with any of that logic. The only other note for the weekend is, and we didn't talk about it with Mike, I completely forgot, Rory McDonald returns to professional fighting. He takes on Paul Daly on Friday night at Bellator. I believe, if I heard this right, that the show is actually tape delayed on Spike, so it's going to be taking place earlier in the day, but we can watch it on tape delay on Spike. It is 2017. Why they still have not figured this out yet is beyond me. I can't imagine anything given the success of Cops. I can't imagine anything being that successful during the day that they just couldn't air it at, like, you know, 4 o'clock or something like that, especially given that, you know, HBO or Showtime rather aired that Anthony Joshua Klitschko fight a couple weeks ago. They aired that as it was happening, and then HBO did it on tape delay. I don't know. Again, it's 2017. They got to figure this out. And hopefully maybe they'll provide a way to watch it. My guess is they won't. But, you know, I'm sure there may be some forms of ways to watch that. Maybe a little bit illegally, or wouldn't it be illegally, but maybe just picking up a stream or something like that from overseas. However, Rory McDonald, Paul Daly happening Friday night, no MVP on that show. And, it's basically really, there's some, Liam McGeary is returning to fight on that show, but really this is about the return of Rory McDonald, see how he looks against a very game fighter in Paul Daly. My expectation is, you know, a 15-minute decision, maybe a few boos here and there, and we'll see what Rory has left in the tank after some of those. Obviously, that hellacious beating he took at the hands of Robbie Lawler several years ago. He returned against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson in his final UFC fight and didn't look that great in that fight. And we'll see what he has left in the tank for Paul Daly. Again, I'm guessing a 15-minute kind of boring decision win, and we're all talking about that on Friday night and Saturday morning. So with all that said, I'm going to let you go. Big thanks to Mike Giappetta. Big thanks to all of you. This has been Josh Jason's Punch-Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.